The police car roars past and cuts off the other car. Sven's feet hit the asphalt before any of them have even come to a stop. For an eternity he stands there in the road, alone, his face streaked with red lines and his lip buckled with bite marks. Finally a car door opens and Omar steps out, a man's eyes in the body of a boy. Is this the end of a childhood? It's the sort of night that can't be undone in a person.
What, Sven? What are you going to tell me to do? That I have too much to lose? What the fuck do I have to lose?
Sven holds out his palms. His eyes flicker towards what Omar is holding in his hands. His voice hardly makes itself heard.
Tell me where it ends, Omar. When you've killed them and they've killed you, tell me where it ends after that.
Omar just stands there dumbly, as if he also has to focus his pain somewhere. Two young men in the back of the car open the doors, but they don't get out, merely sit there waiting for Omar to make a choice. Britt Marie recognizes them. They play football with Sammy and Magnus in the glare of headlights from Sammy's black car. How long ago did they last play? Days? Weeks? A whole lifetime ago. They're almost boys. Death is powerlessness. Powerlessness is desperation. Desperate people choose desperate measures. Britt Marie's hair moves in the draft when the door of the police car opens and Vega steps out. She looks at her brother. He's on his knees now. She keeps his head pressed against her throat and whispers,
"Where would Sammy have stood?"
When he doesn't immediately answer, she repeats,
"Where would Sammy have stood?"
"Between us," he pants.
The two young men give Sven one last look. At another time, perhaps they could have been stopped. One day it may be possible to stop them again, but not tonight. The car leaves Britt Marie, Sven and two children in the road. Dawn rises over them. The police car slowly drives back through Borg, exits on the other side, continues down a gravel track, keeps driving forever, until Britt Marie no longer knows if she's fallen asleep or just gone numb. They stop by a lake. Britt Marie wraps the pistol in every handkerchief she's got in her bag. She doesn't know why, mainly perhaps because she doesn't want the girl to get dirty. Vega insists she's got to be the one that does it. She gets out and throws it as hard as she can into the lake. Britt Marie doesn't know how the hours turn into days or how many of them pass by. By night, she sleeps between the children in Sammy's bed, the beating of their hearts in her hands. She stays there for several nights. It is not something she plans, no decision has been made. She just stays there. One dawn after another seems to merge with dusk. Looking back, she has a vague memory of having spoken to Kent on the telephone, but she can't remember what was said. She thinks she may have asked him to arrange some practical things. Possibly she asks him to make some telephone calls. He's good at those things. Everyone says Kent is good at those things. One afternoon, she's unsure when it is, Sven comes to the apartment. He has brought a young woman with him from the social services. She's warm and pleasant. Sven's neck doesn't seem capable of holding up all his thoughts any longer. The woman sits with them all at the kitchen table, speaking slowly and softly, but no one is able to concentrate. Britt Marie's eyes keep straying out of the window. One of the children is looking up at the ceiling and the other is looking down at the floor. The following night, Britt Marie is woken by a sound of slamming in the flat. She gets up and fumbles for the light switch. The wind is blowing in through the balcony door. Vega moves manically, back and forth in the kitchen, tidying up, cleaning everything she finds. Her hands scrub frenetically at the draining board and frying pans, again and again, as if they were magic lamps that could give her everything back. Britt Marie's hands hesitate in the air behind her shaking shoulders. Her fingers grip without touching.
"I'm so sorry.
I know you must feel..."
"I don't have time to feel things. I have to take care of Omar,"
the girl interrupts vacantly. Britt-Marie wants to touch her, but the girl moves away, so Britt-Marie fetches her bag, gets out some bicarbonate of soda. The girl meets her eyes, and her sorrow has nothing else to say. Words cannot achieve anything. So they keep cleaning until morning comes again, although not even bicarbonate of soda can help against this. It's a Sunday in January. While Liverpool are playing Stoke, 1,000 kilometres away, Sammy is buried next to his mother, sleeping softly under a carpet of red flowers, mourned by 2 siblings, missed by a whole community. Omar leaves a scarf in the churchyard. Britt-Marie serves coffee in the pizzeria and makes sure each of the mourners has a coaster. Everyone in Borg is there. The gravelled parking area has lit candles around its boundary. White jerseys have been neatly hung up on the wooden plank fence next to it. Some of them are new, and some so old and faded that they've turned grey. But they all remember. Vega stands in the doorway in a freshly ironed dress and with her hair combed. She receives people's condolences as if they have a greater right to mourn than herself. Mechanically, shakes their hands. Her eyes are empty as if someone has turned off a switch inside her. Something is making a thumping noise outside in the parking area, but no one listens to it. Britt-Marie tries to get Vega to eat, but Vega doesn't even answer when spoken to. She allows herself to be led to the table and lowered into a chair, but her body reacts as if it's sleeping. It turns so that she faces the wall, as though she wants to avoid any possible physical contact. The thumping gets louder. Britt-Marie's despair intensifies. People have different ways of experiencing powerlessness and grief, but for Britt-Marie, it's never so strong as when she's unable to get someone to eat. The mumbling voices from the crowded pizzeria grow into a hurricane in her ears. Her resigned hand fumbles for Vega's shoulder as if it were reaching over the edge of a precipice. But the shoulder moves away, glides towards the hall, and the eyes flee inwards. The plate remains untouched. When the thumping from the parking area gets even louder, as if trying to prove something, Britt-Marie turns angrily towards the door with her hands clenched so tightly that the bandage comes loose from her fingers. She's just about to scream when she feels the girl's body pushing past her through the throng of people. Max is standing outside, leaning on his crutches. He suspends himself from his armpits, his whole weight swinging through the air, and then swings his uninjured leg at the football, firing it at a tight angle so it flies first against the wall of the recreation centre, then at the wooden fence where the white jerseys are hanging, then back at him. Da-dunk-dunk, it sounds like. Da-dunk-dunk. 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 Like a heartbeat. When Vega gets close enough, he lets the ball roll past him without turning around. It rolls up to her and stops against her feet. Her toes touch it through her shoes. She leans over it and runs her fingertips over the stitched leather. Then she cries without measure. 1,000 kilometres away, Liverpool win, 5-3. Chapter 35. Omar and Dino are the first to throw themselves into the game with Vega. At first they're guarded, as if every movement is made in sorrow. But before long, they're playing as if it's just another evening. They play without memory because they don't know any other way of doing it. More children turn up, first Toad and Ben, but soon others too. Britt-Marie doesn't recognize every one of them, but they all have jeans that are ripped over their thighs. They play as if they live in Borg. Britt-Marie, says Sven in a formal tone that she's not used to. He's standing beside her with a very tall man, really astonishingly tall. Britt-Marie doesn't even know how one could manage to have fully functional lighting at home with him around. Huh? She says. Sven presents Dino's uncle in an English marred by a heavy accent, but Britt-Marie doesn't criticise. She's not the sort of person that criticises. Hello, says Britt-Marie. This being about the long and short of the conversation for her part. It's not that Britt-Marie can't speak English, It's just that she doesn't know how to speak it without feeling like an utter prat. She wouldn't even know how to say utter prat in English. As far as she's concerned, this illustrates her point very well. The very tall man, who really is quite unreasonably tall, points at Dino and explains that they lived in 3 countries and 7 cities before they came to Borg. Sven helpfully translates. Britt Marie understands English perfectly well, but she lets him go on, fearing that she might otherwise be expected to say something. The tall man's mouth judders up and down in a melancholy way when he says that small children don't remember things, which is a blessing. But Dino was old enough to see and hear and remember. He remembers everything they had to flee from. "He's saying he still hardly says anything, only with them," Sven explains, pointing out of the window. Britt Marie clasps one hand in the other. The tall man does the same. "Sammy," he says, with a sort of music in the way he pronounces the name, as if he's nursing every nuance of sound. Her eyelashes grow heavy. He says that Sammy saw a boy walking on his own in the road. Vega and the others called out and asked him if he wanted to play, but he didn't understand, so Sammy rolled a ball over to him and then he kicked it, says Sven. Britt Marie looks at the tall man and her common sense prevents her from saying that once when she and Kent were staying at a hotel and someone had left a foreign newspaper behind, she almost solved the crossword in English entirely on her own. "Thank you," says the tall man. "He wants to thank you for coaching the team. It meant a lot..." Britt Marie interrupts him because she understands. "I'm the one who should say thank you." Sven starts translating to the tall man, but he stops him because he also understands. He presses Britt Marie's hand. She goes back into the pizzeria with Sven following and helps somebody clear glasses and plates from the tables. "It was a beautiful funeral," says Sven, "because that's what you say." "Very beautiful," says Britt Marie, "because you have to say that as well." He gets something out of his pocket and hands it to her. The keys to her car. His eyes flicker. Through the window they see Kent's BMW pulling into the parking area. "I assume you'll be going home now, you and Kent," says Sven, his eyes remote. "It's best that way," says Britt Marie, sucking in her cheeks. But then a few more words slip out of her, in spite of it all. "Unless I'm needed here with Vega and Omar." Sven looks up and crumples in the brief instant between the first question and the realization that what she's asking is whether the children need her, not whether he does.
I have contacted the social services. They have sent a girl to Borg," he says with a grim expression, as if he's already forgotten that it was actually several nights earlier that he first brought the girl to the children.
"Of course," she says.
"You'll like her. I've worked with her many times before. She's a good person. She wants what's best for them. She's not like you imagine the social services could be."
Britt Marie mops the sweat from her brow with a handkerchief, so he doesn't notice that she's also mopping her eyes.
"I promised Sammy they'd be all right. I promised. They have to have an opportunity to... There must be a sunny story in their lives, Sven, at some point," she manages to say at long last.
"We're going to do our best. We'll all do everything we possibly can."
Of course," she replies, directing her words at her shoes.
Sven fingers the police cap in his hands.
"The girl from the council, yes, she'll be staying with the children for a few days until they've sorted it all out. She's very considerate. You don't have to worry about that. I've been asked to drive the children home tonight."
It takes a few seconds before the significance of what he has said sinks in for Britt Marie, before she's hit with the insight that she's no longer needed.
Obviously, it's best that way, obviously," she whispers.
Outside on the football pitch, Kent has got out of his BMW. He sees Britt Marie and Sven through the window and puts his hands in his pockets, slightly nonplussed, looking as if he's standing on a street corner and not quite willing to admit that he's lost. He's never been good at talking about death. Britt Marie knows that. He's the kind of person who can sort out all the practicalities, he can make calls, he'll kiss your eyelids. But he's never been good at feeling things. His eyes seem to be considering walking into the pizzeria, but his feet steer off in the opposite direction. He makes a few movements, with which he seems to be heading back into the BMW. But then the football comes rolling up and stops by his feet. Omar is standing a few meters away. Kent puts the sole of his shoe on the ball and looks at the boy, kicks the ball to him. Omar stops it with the side of his foot, so it bounces back to Kent. 30 seconds later, Kent is in the middle of the pile of children, his shirt creased and hanging down outside his belt, his hair untidy. Instantly he's happy. When the ball comes flying to him at knee height, he gathers himself and kicks as hard as he can, misses the ball, and watches one of his shoes flying off and clearing the top of the fence along the side of the recreation centre. "Mother of God," mumbles Britt Marie from the window. The children watch the shoe flying off, turn to Kent. He looks back at them and starts laughing. They also laugh. He plays the rest of the match with one shoe, and when he scores, he runs around the pitch with Omar perched on his back. Omar hugs him a little too hard, a little too long, as teenagers get few chances to do outside of a football pitch. Kent hugs him back, because football allows him to do it. Sven has turned away from the window when he mumbles, "Don't dislike me, Britt Marie, for not calling the social services earlier. I just wanted to give Sammy the chance to get things organised. I just wanted to give him the chance. Don't dislike me for it." Her fingers skim through the air between them as close as they can without actually touching him. "Quite the opposite, Sven. Quite the opposite." He looks about to say something, so she quickly interjects. "There are more kids here now than earlier. Where are they all from?" Sven puts his police cap back on his head. It ends up slightly wonky. "They've been coming here every evening since the cup. More and more of them every evening. If it carries on like this, soon Borg won't be a team, it'll be a club." Britt Marie doesn't know what that means, but it sounds beautiful. She thinks Sammy would have liked it. They look so happy. "Even in the midst of all this, they can look so happy when they're playing," she says, almost enviously. Sven rubs the back of his hand against his beard stubble. He looks tired. She has never seen him tired. But at long last, the corners of his mouth twitch slightly, his eyes glitter at her, and he says, "Football forces life to move on. There's always a new match, a new season. There's always a dream that everything can get better. It's a game of wonders." Britt Marie straightens out a crease in his shirt, her hand landing as lightly as a butterfly, without actually touching his body under the fabric. "If it's not too inappropriate, I should like to ask you a very personal question, Sven."
"Of course."
"What football team do you support?" Surprised, his face releases and changes.
"I've never supported a team. I think I love football too much. Sometimes your passion for a team can get in the way of your love for the game."
It seems quite fitting for a man like Sven that he should believe more in love than in passion. He's a policeman who believes more in justice than in the law. It suits him, she thinks to herself, but she doesn't tell him as much. "Poetic," she says.
"Course,"
he smiles back. She wants to say so much more. Maybe he does too. But in the end, all he can manage to utter is,
"I want you to know, Britt Marie, that every time there's a knock on my front door, I hope it's you."
Maybe he's also intending to say something bigger, but he holds off and he walks away. She wants to call out to him, but it's too late. The door tinkles cheerfully behind him because doors really don't seem to get when the moment is or isn't right. Britt Marie dabs her cheeks with a handkerchief so no one can see she's wiping her eyes. Then she walks purposefully through the pizzeria to somebody. There are still people everywhere. Ben's mother and Dino's uncle and Toad's parents, but also a lot of other people whose faces Britt Marie can only dimly recall from the football cup. They're cleaning up and putting the chairs in order, and she only just manages to resist the urge to straighten them again.
It was, what's it called? Beautiful funeral, huh? Says somebody, her voice a little gravelly.
Yes, agrees Britt Marie, before getting out her wallet and immediately continuing. I should like to ask what I owe you for the car door. Somebody drums the edge of her wheelchair.
Well, I've been, you know, thinking about that car, huh, Britt Marie? I don't have good car mechanica. Maybe did it wrong, you know, so first you check the worker, then you come back.
Hey, I don't understand. Somebody scratches her cheek so no one can see she's wiping her eyes as well.
Britt Marie, very honest person, huh? Britt Marie does not steal. So then I know. Britt Marie comes back to Borg, huh? To pay.
Of course, she replies, turning away. Of course. She wants to get busy cleaning up, but then has a merciless realization that the people she does not know inside the pizzeria have already done it. Somebody has already told them all what to do, and now there is nothing left to finish. Britt Marie is not needed here anymore. She stands on her own in the doorway until the children stop playing. They go home, one after the other. At a distance, Sven waits patiently for Vega and Omar. He lets the children take the time they need. Vega goes directly to the back seat and closes the door behind her. But Omar wanders on his own along the plank and runs his fingers across the white jerseys. He leans over the candles on the ground, carefully picks one up that has gone out, and relights it by holding it over the flame of another, then puts it back. When he straightens up, he sees Britt Marie in the doorway. His hand moves almost unnoticeably away from his hip in a little wave. A wave from a young man is much more than a wave from a child. She waves back as much as she can without showing him that she's crying. She goes down to the parking area just as the police car pulls into the road and heads off towards the children's house. Kent is waiting for her.
Sweaty, his shirt creased and hanging loose, his hair on end to one side of his large head, and he still only has one shoe. He looks quite, quite mad. It reminds her of how he used to look when they were children. Back then, it never bothered him that other people would shake their heads at him. He was never afraid of making a fool of himself. He never needed anyone's affirmation, except hers.
He takes her hand and she presses her eyelids against his lips, says, almost panting, Vega? Is afraid, even if she mainly seems angry. Omar is angry, even if he mostly seems afraid.
Everything is going to be all right, says Kent, into her hair.
I promised Sammy their lives would work out, sobs Britt Marie.
They're going to be fine. You have to let the authorities take care of this, he says calmly.
I know, of course I do know that. They're not your children, darling.
She doesn't answer because she knows, obviously she knows that. Instead, she straightens her back and wipes her eyes with a tissue, adjusts a crease in her skirt and several in Kent's shirt, collects herself and clasps her hands over her stomach and asks him,
I should like to take care of a last errand tomorrow, in town, if it's not too much trouble.
I'll go with you. You don't always have to stand next to me, Kent.
Yes, I do. Then he smiles, and she tries too.
But when he starts walking back to the BMW, she stays where she is, with her heels dug into the gravel, as you do when enough is finally enough.
No, Kent, certainly not. I am certainly not going into town with you if you don't first put on both your shoes.
Chapter 36.
One remarkable thing about communities built along roads is that you can find just as many reasons for leaving them as excuses to stay. Some people never quite stop devoting themselves to one or the other. In the end, it's almost a whole week after the funeral before Britt Marie gets into her white car with its blue door and drives off along the road that leaves Borg. Admittedly, it's not entirely the fault of the council employees in the town hall. Possibly they are only trying to do their jobs. It is not their fault that they are not wholly aware of Britt Marie's precision when ticking off her lists. So on the first day, a Monday, the young man who is working temporarily on reception at the town hall looks as if he thinks Britt Marie is trying to be amusing. The reception opens at 8 o'clock, so Britt Marie and Kent have turned up at 8:02 because Britt Marie doesn't want to come across as pig-headed.
Borg,
says the temporary receptionist in the sort of tone you might use when pronouncing the names of beasts in fairy tales. My dear boy, surely you can't be working for the council without knowing that Borg is a part of the local council, Britt Marie says.
I'm not from here. I'm a temp.
Ha, and I suppose that's meant to be an excuse for not having to know anything at all? But Kent nudges her encouragingly in the side and whispers to her that she should try to be a little more diplomatic. So she grimly collects herself, smiles considerately at the young man and says,
It was very brave of you, putting that tie on, because it looks absolutely preposterous.
Following this, there is a series of opinions exchanged that could not exactly be described as diplomatic, but in the end, Kent manages to calm down both combatants to the extent that the young man promises not to call the security guards, and Britt Marie promises not to try to strike him with her handbag again. One curious thing about communities built along roads is that you don't need to spend very long in them before you're deeply and personally offended when young men don't even know these places are there, that they even exist. I've come here to demand that a football pitch should be built in Borg for your information, Britt Marie explains with her most goddess-like patience. She points at her list. The young man looks through a file. He turns demonstratively to Kent and says something about a committee which is currently held up in a meeting. For how long? The young man continues going through the file.
It's a breakfast meeting, so more or less until about 10 o'clock.
Whereupon both she and Kent have to leave the town hall because a newly aggressive Britt Marie has taken umbrage at the idea of a breakfast that lasts until 10 o'clock, causing the young man to break his promise about not calling the security guards. They come back at 10 o'clock, only to learn that the committee is in a meeting until after lunch. They come back after lunch, when they find out that the committee is in a meeting for the rest of the day. Britt Marie clarifies her errand to the young man because she does not believe it should have to take a whole day to get it done. The security guard, who the young man has called, takes the view that her clarity is somewhat overstated. He tells Kent that if Britt Marie does this one more time, he'll have no option but to take her handbag away from her. Kent sniggers and says in that case the security guard is a braver man than Kent. Britt Marie doesn't know whether to feel insulted or proud about it.
We'll come back tomorrow, darling, don't worry about it, Kent says soothingly as they're walking out. You have your meetings, Kent. We have to go home, I understand that, of course I do understand that. I just hope that we manage to...
She takes a breath so deep that it seems to be extracted from the bottom of her handbag.
When Vega plays football, she doesn't feel any pain anymore.
Pain about what?
Everything.
Kent lowers his head for a moment in thought.
It doesn't matter, darling, we'll come back tomorrow.
Britt Marie adjusts the bandage on her hand.
I'm aware of the fact that the children don't need me. Obviously, I am aware of that, Kent. I just wish I could give them something, at least if I could give them a football pitch.
We'll come back tomorrow, Kent repeats as he opens the car door for her.
Yes, yes, you have your meetings. I understand that you have your meetings. We have to go home, she says with a sigh.
Kent scratches his head distractedly, coughs gently, fixes his gaze on the rubber seal between the glass and the metal of the door and answers,
The fact is, darling, I only have one meeting with the car dealer.
Huh. I didn't realise you were planning to buy a new car. I'm not buying.
I'm selling this one, says Kent, with a nod at the BMW that she's just got into. His face is dejected, as if it knows this is what is expected of it. But when he shrugs, he does it, as a young boy might. Then his shoulders are light and relaxed, as if they've just been liberated from a heavy burden.
The company has gone bankrupt, darling. I tried to save it for as long as I could, but... well, it's the financial crisis.
Britt Marie gawps at him.
But I thought you said the crisis was over.
He considers this for a moment, then simply says,
I was wrong, darling. Totally, totally wrong.
What are you going to do?
He smiles, unconcerned and youthful.
Start again, that's what you do, isn't it? Once upon a time I had nothing, remember?
She does remember. Her fingers seek out his. They may be old, but he's laughing.
I built a whole life, I can do it again.
He holds her hands in his and looks into her eyes when he promises.
I can become that man again, my darling.
They're halfway between town and Borg when Britt Marie turns to him and asks how things have gone for Manchester United. He laughs out loud. It's heavenly.
Ah, it's gone to pot. They've had their worst season in more than 20 years. The manager is going to get kicked out any moment.
How come?
They forgot what made them successful.
What do you do when that happens?
You start again.
He rents a room from Toad's parents for the night. Britt Marie doesn't ask if he'd prefer to stay in Banks's house, because Kent admits, that blind old bat scares me a bit. The next day they go back to the town hall, and the next. Probably some of the people who work at the town hall believe that sooner or later Britt Marie and Kent will give up. But these people are simply not aware of the profound implications of writing your lists in ink. On the fourth day they are allowed to see a man in a suit who's a member of a committee. By lunchtime, he has called in a woman and a man, both wearing suits. Whether this is because of their expertise in the relevant area, or simply because the first suited man wants to improve his odds of not being hit in the event that Britt Marie starts lashing out with her handbag, is never clarified.
I've heard a lot of good things about Borg. It seems so charming there,
says the woman encouragingly, as if the village, some 20 kilometres from her office, is an exotic island only accessible through reliance on magic spells. I am here about a football pitch, Britt Marie begins.
There's no budget for that, the second suited man informs them.
As I already said, the first suited man points out. In that case, I have to demand that you change the budget.
That's absolutely out of the question. How would that look? Then we'd have to start making changes in all the budgets, says the second suited man, terrified.
The suited woman smiles and asks if Britt Marie wants some coffee. Britt Marie doesn't. The suited woman's smile intensifies.
The way we understand it, Borg already has a football pitch.
The second man in a suit makes a dissatisfied humming sound from between his teeth and almost yells,
No, the football pitch was sold off for the eventual building of apartments. It's in the budget.
Well, in that case, I have to ask you to buy back the land.
The humming from between the suited man's teeth is now also accompanied by a fountain of saliva.
How would that look? If that happened, everyone would want to sell their land back. We actually can't just go around building football pitches everywhere. We'd be swimming in football pitches.
Well, says the first man in a suit and looks at his watch with a very bored expression.
Kent has to grip Britt Marie's handbag quite firmly at that point. The suited woman leans forward disarmingly and pours coffee for everyone, although no one actually wants any.
We understand that you are employed at the recreation centre in Borg, she says with a mild smile.
Yes, yes, that's right, but I have handed in my notice, says Britt Marie, sucking in her cheeks. The woman smiles even more mildly and pushes the coffee cup closer to Britt Marie.
There was never meant to be a position there, dear Brit Marie. The intention was to close down the recreation centre before Christmas. The vacancy was a mistake. The second suited man is droning like an outboard engine.
A position not in the budget, how would that look?
The first suited man stands up. You'll have to excuse us, we actually have an important meeting. And on this note, Brit Marie leaves the town hall, having come to realise that her arrival in Borg was all a mistake. They're right. Obviously they are right. Tomorrow, darling, we'll come back here tomorrow, Kent tries to tell her again as they sit in the BMW. Silent and dejected, she leans her head against the window and keeps a tissue under her chin. A sort of determination appears in Kent's eyes when he sees this, almost like something vengeful. But she doesn't notice it at that point. The fifth day at the town hall is a Friday. It's raining again. Kent has to force Brit Marie to go. When she insists that it's all useless anyway, he has no choice in the end but to threaten to write a lot of mischievous, quite irrelevant things in ink on her list. At this point, she snatches back the list as if it was a flower pot he had threatened to throw off a balcony, and then she reluctantly gets into the BMW, all the while muttering that Kent is a hooligan. A woman is waiting for them when they arrive at the town hall. Brit Marie recognises her as the woman from the Football Association.
Ha! Huh? I suppose you're here to stop us, notes Brit Marie.
The woman looks at Kent, surprised, nervously starts wringing her hands.
No. Kent here called me. I am here to help you.
Kent pats Brit Marie on the shoulder.
I made a couple of calls. I took the liberty of doing what I'm good at.
When Brit Marie steps into the suited people's office, there are even more suits in there. Under existing circumstances, it seems, the football pitch in Borg has become a matter of interest for more committees than just the one.
It has come to our attention that strong interests are backing the initiative for more football pitches within our council boundaries, says a new suit, with a nod at the woman from the Football Association.
It has also come to our attention that local business interests are ready to exert a certain amount of, pressure, says another suit.
Fairly unpleasant pressure, actually,
a third suit interjects, producing a plastic folder with various papers inside and putting this on the table in front of Brit Marie.
We have also been reminded, both by mail and various telephone calls, that this is election year, says the aforementioned suit.
We have been reminded in a fairly abrasive and persistent way, in fact, the latter suit adds.
Brit Marie leans forward. The papers are headed as Working Group of Borg's Official Partnership of Independent Business Interests. In these papers, it can be clearly seen that the owners of Borg's Pizzeria, Borg's Corner Shop, Borg's Post Office and Borg's Car Repairs Workshop have sat down together over the course of the night and signed a collective demand for a football pitch. For safety's sake, the owners of the very recent startups, law firm Sun & Sun, Hairdressing and That, and Borg Good Wine Importers Limited have also signed this demand. As it happens, all in the same handwriting. The only document that stands out as different is one from a man named Carl, who according to the document has just opened a florist's. Everything else is in Kent's handwriting. He stands behind Brit Marie with his hands in his pockets, slouching slightly, as if he does not wish to make too much of his presence. The woman with a suit serves coffee and nods excitedly.
Actually, I had no idea there was such a flourishing business community in Borg. How charming!
Brit Marie's common sense has to work hard to stop her running around the room with her arms stretched out like an aircraft, because she's almost certain this would not be very appropriate. The first man with a suit clears his throat and wishes to say another few words. He says,
The thing is, we have now also been contacted by the unemployment office in your hometown. 21 times. 21 times we've been contacted,
another suit points out. Britt-Marie turns and looks at Kent for guidance, but he's now standing with his mouth agape, looking just as shocked as she is. An apparently randomly picked suit points at another paper. "It has come to our attention that you have been employed at the recreation centre in Borg."
"Mistakenly so," the woman in a suit says, with a mild smile.
The random suit continues without missing a beat. "The unemployment office in your town has made us aware of certain political responsibilities arising out of this. We have also been made aware of a certain amount of flexibility in the local council budget concerning further recruitment, which could be acted on now that, well, now that we are in an election year."
21 times.
21 times we have been made aware of this, another suit interjects angrily. Words fail Britt-Marie. She stutters and clears her throat and then at long last manages to burst out.
"Might I just ask what on earth all this is supposed to mean?"
All of the suits in the room make restrained groans about how this must surely be quite plain and obvious. The suit sleeves slide back collectively to check if it isn't time to have lunch. It is. A great impatience arises. One of the suits finally takes it upon himself to clarify the whole thing, and then looks wearily at Britt-Marie.
"It means that the local council will either budget for a new football pitch or budget for you to keep your job. We can't afford to do both."
It's not a reasonable choice to give a human being. One remarkable thing about communities built along roads is that you can find just as many reasons for leaving them as excuses to make you stay. Chapter 37.
"I must ask you to try to understand that it isn't a reasonable choice to give a human being," says Britt-Marie.
When she doesn't get an answer, she explains.
"It's just intractable, you have to understand. I want to ask you to try not to hold it against me."
She still doesn't get an answer, so she sucks in her cheeks and adjusts her skirt. "It's very neat and tidy here. Of course, I don't know if this makes any difference to you now, but I hope it does. It's a very neat and tidy churchyard, this."
Sammy doesn't answer, but she hopes he's listening when she says,
"I want you to know, darling boy, I'll never regret coming to Borg." It's Saturday afternoon, the day after the local council gave her an unreasonable choice, and the very same day that Liverpool are playing Aston Villa, 1,000 kilometres from Borg. Early this morning, Britt-Marie went to the recreation centre. "On Monday, there'll be bulldozers on the gravel outside. The council has promised. Kent forced them to promise, because he said otherwise he would not let them go to have their lunch. And so they promised and crossed their hearts that turf would be laid down and there would be proper goals with nets, proper chalked sidelines." It was not a reasonable choice to give a human being, but Britt-Marie remembered what it was like losing a sibling. She remembered just how much one could lose oneself. With this in mind, she felt this was the best possible thing she could give someone who was every bit as lost. A football pitch. She could hear voices through the open door of the pizzeria, but she didn't go in. It was best that way, she felt. The recreation centre was empty, but the door of the refrigerator was ajar. The rat teeth marks on the rubber seal of the door made it clear enough what had happened. The cellophane over the plate had been chewed away, and every last crumb of peanut butter and Nutella on it had been licked clean. On its way out, the rat had stumbled on Britt-Marie's tin of bicarbonate of soda, overturning it on the draining board. There were tracks in the white dust, two pairs in fact. The rat had been there on a date, or a meeting, or whatever they called it these days. Britt-Marie sat on one of the stools for a long time, with a towel in her lap. Then she mopped her face and cleaned the kitchen, washed up and disinfected and made sure everything was spotless, patted the coffee machine, which had once been damaged by flying stones, ran her hand over a picture with a red dot hanging at precisely the right height on the wall, telling her exactly where she was. The knocking on the door didn't surprise her, oddly enough. The young woman from social services standing in the doorway gave her the impression of being exactly in the right place, as if she belonged here.
"Hello, Britt Marie," said the girl. "I hope I'm not disturbing you. I saw that the lights were on."
"Certainly not. I only came to leave the keys," Britt Marie informed her in a low voice, feeling like a guest in someone else's house. She held out the keys to the recreation center, but the girl did not take them. Just smiled warmly as she looked at the premises.
"It's very nice here.
I've understood that this place means so much to Vega and Omar. I wanted to have a look at it so I could understand them better." Britt Marie fumbled with the keys, stifled everything welling up inside her, checked several times that she had put all of her things in her handbag and that she had really turned off the lights in the bathroom and kitchen, galvanized herself several times to say what she wanted to say, even though her common sense was fighting tooth and nail to stop her. Would it make any difference if someone offered to take care of the children? She wanted to ask. Obviously she knew it was preposterous. Obviously she did. Yet she had time to open her mouth and then to say,
"Would it? I should just like your leave to ask whether, obviously, it's quite preposterous, certainly it is, but I should like to inquire about the wither and weather of whether it might happen to make any difference if someone..."
Before she got to the end of the sentence, she noticed Toad's parents standing in the doorway. The mother had her hands on her pregnant stomach, and the father held his cap in his hands.
"Are you the one who's picking up the children?" Carl demanded to know.
The mother elbowed him softly in his side, and then turned in a very forthright manner to the girl from the social services.
"My name is Sonia, this is Carl, we're Patrick's parents. He plays in the same football team as Vega and Omar."
Of course, it is quite possible that the girl from the social services was intending to answer, but Carl did not give her the chance.
"We want to take care of the children. We want them to come and live with us. You can't take them away from Borg."
Sonia looked at Britt Marie, saw her hands, perhaps, so she crossed the room and, without any sort of prior warning, gave her a hug. Britt Marie mumbled something about having washing up liquid on her fingers, but despite that, Sonia kept hugging her. Something was rattling in the doorway. The girl from the social services began to laugh a little, as if this was her natural impulse every time she opened her mouth.
"The fact is, I've had the same suggestion from both Ben's mother and the uncle of Dino, is that his name?"
The rattling sounds from the doorway intensified and were complemented by a person demonstratively clearing her throat.
"Those kids can live with Mia. They're like, what's it called, children for Mia."
Somebody looked ready to fight about it with everyone in the room. She waved at the football pitch. There were still white jerseys hanging along the fence, and the candles had been thoughtfully lit again earlier that morning.
"It takes, what's it called, takes a village to bring up a child, huh? We have a village."
Sonia reluctantly let go of Britt Marie, like you do with a balloon that you know will fly off as soon as you loosen your grip. Carl wrung his cap and pointed both exactingly and fearfully at the girl from the social services.
"You can't take the children away from Borg. They could end up living with anyone. They could end up with a Chelsea supporter."
By that stage, Britt Marie had already put the keys to the recreation center on the draining board and sneaked out behind them. If they did notice, and maybe they did, they let her go without a word, because they liked her enough to do that. Afternoon turns to evening in Borg, quick and merciless, as if dusk is pulling a plaster off the daylight. Britt Marie kneels with her forehead against Sammy's headstone.
"My darling boy, I'll never regret that I was here."
On Monday, the bulldozers are coming to Borg. Britt Marie doesn't know if she is religious, but she imagines that it's good enough, the knowledge that God has plans for Borg. She has grass stains on her tights when she walks on her own down the road through the village. The white jerseys are still there on the fence. New candles have been lit underneath. The recreation center is lit up by the glow of a television,
and she can see the shadows of the children's heads inside. More children now than ever. A club, more than a team. She wants to go in, but she understands this would not be appropriate. Understands that it's best this way. In the gravelled parking area between the recreation centre and the pizzeria are two quite gigantic old trucks with their headlights turned on. A group of grown men with beards and caps are moving about in the beams of light, huffing and puffing, groaning and shoving each other. It takes a good while before Britt-Marie understands. They are playing football. They are playing. She continues down the road, stands for a few heartbeats outside a modest little house with a modest little garden. If you didn't know it was there, you could easily walk past without paying any attention to it. And in this sense, the house has a great deal in common with its owner. The police car is not parked outside. The windows are not lit up. Once she's absolutely certain that Sven is not at home, Britt-Marie sneaks up to the door and knocks on it. Because she wanted to do that once in her life. Then she quickly moves off, keeping herself to the shadows, and walks the remaining distance to Banks' house. The flower bed outside no longer stinks. The for sale sign on the lawn has been removed. There's a smell of fried eggs when Britt-Marie steps into the hall. The dog is sleeping on the floor. Bank is sitting in her armchair in the living room with her face pressed up, so close to the TV that Britt-Marie actually wants to warn her that it might be harmful to her eyes, but on second thoughts realises it would be better not to. "Might one ask who's playing?" she says instead.
"Aston Villa and Liverpool. Aston Villa are leading 2-0, says Bank, very agitated.
"Ah, so should I presume then that you also support Liverpool, like all the children seem to?"
"Are you mad? I support Aston Villa," hisses Bank.
"Might I ask why?" asks Britt-Marie, because when she thinks about it more closely, it occurs to her that this is the first time she has ever seen Bank pay any attention to a televised football match. Bank looks as if this is a preposterous question, thinks for a moment, then answers grumpily.
"Because no one else supports Aston Villa, and because they have nice jerseys."
Britt-Marie finds the second argument a touch more rational than the first. Bank lifts her head, turns down the volume on the TV, takes a pull at the beer and clears her throat.
"There's food in the kitchen, if you're hungry."
Britt-Marie shakes her head, clutches her handbag hard. "Kent is coming. Soon. We're going home. He's driving his car, and I am driving mine, but he'll drive in front of me, of course. I don't like driving in the dark. It's best if he's at the front." Bank gets to her feet with a lot of laborious cursing at the armchair, as if it's the chair's fault that people get older.
"Not that I want to get involved, but I think you should learn to drive in the dark."
"That's very sweet of you," answers Britt-Marie into her handbag. Bank and the dog give her a hand with the bags and the balcony box from upstairs. Britt-Marie washes up and cleans the kitchen, sorts cutlery, pats the dog behind its ears. A person on the TV starts yelling loudly. Bank disappears into the living room and comes back looking irascible.
"Liverpool just scored. Now it's 2-1, she mutters.
Britt-Marie walks around the house one last time, straightens rugs and curtains. When she comes down into the kitchen, she says, "I'm not the kind to stick my nose in, but I could hardly avoid noticing that the for sale sign on the lawn has been taken down. I'd just like to congratulate you on getting your house sold." Bank laughs bitterly.
"Are you joking? Who would buy a house in Borg?"
Britt-Marie adjusts her skirt. "It wasn't an unreasonable assumption to make, given that you just removed the sign."
"Ah, I thought I'd stay on in Borg for a while, that's all. I was thinking I'd go and have a word with my old man. I thought it might be easier now he's dead, because he can't interrupt me all the time."
Britt-Marie wants to pat her on the shoulder, but she realises it's best to leave it. Not least because Bank has her stick within reach. There's a knock. Bank goes into the hall, but then continues on into the living room without opening the door, because she knows who it is.
Britt Marie looks around the kitchen one last time, runs her fingers close enough to the walls to feel them, but not close enough to touch them. They are very dirty, after all. She hasn't had time to sort them out. She would have needed more time in Borg for that. Kent smiles with relief when she opens the door. "Are you ready to go?" he says, anxiously, as if he still fears she may change her mind. She nods and grasps her bag. Then the commentator on the TV suddenly starts roaring like mad. It sounds as if someone has walloped him. "What on earth is going on?" Britt Marie exclaims. "Let's go now, or we could get stuck in the traffic," Kent tries. But it's too late. Britt Marie goes into the living room. Bank is swearing and hissing at a young man in a red shirt who's charging about, yelling until his face turns purple. 2-2, Liverpool have equalised, it's 2-2, she mutters, kicking the armchair as if it's responsible for the situation. Britt Marie is already halfway out of the door. Kent's BMW is parked in the street. He comes running and reaches out to her, but she pulls away. Of course, it's not appropriate at all, a grown woman running as if she was a criminal, fleeing justice. She stops herself by the edge of the pavement, her breath hot in her throat, and she turns around and looks at Kent, with tears streaming down her face.
"What are you doing, darling? We have to go now," he says, but his voice breaks because he can probably recognise very clearly what she's doing. Her skirt is creased, but she doesn't adjust it. Her hair is almost untidy as it is possible for Britt Marie's hair to be. Her common sense throws in the towel in the end and allows her to raise her voice.
"Liverpool have equalised. I think they're going to win."
Kent allows his chin to sink towards his chest. He shrinks.
"You can't be their mother, darling. And even if you can, what'll happen after that when they don't need you any more? What happens then?"
She shakes her head, but defiantly, rebelliously, not with sadness and dejection, as if she's fully intending to jump off an edge, even if only the edge of the pavement.
"I don't know, Kent. I don't know what happens after that."
He closes his eyes, looking once again like a young boy on a landing, and then says in a quiet voice, "I can only wait till tomorrow morning, Britt Marie. I'll stay with Toad's parents. If you don't come knocking on the door in the morning, I'm going home on my own." He tries to say it in a confident way, even though he knows he has already lost her. She is already halfway to the recreation centre. Omar and Vega see her before she sees them. She has already run past them when she hears them calling out irritably to her.
"Goodness gracious, Liverpool have... Well, I certainly don't know exactly what they've done, but I am under the impression that they're going to win against these, whatever their name was, Villa something,"
pants Britt Marie, so out of breath that she sees stars and has to steady herself in the middle of the road by resting her hands on her knees. The neighbours must surely be wondering whether she started using narcotics.
"We know," Omar joins in eagerly. "We're going to win. You could see it in Gerard's eyes when he scored that we're going to win."
Britt Marie looks up, breathing so heavily that she feels a migraine coming on.
"May I ask what on earth you are doing here in the middle of the road, then?"
Vega faces her, with her hands in her pockets, shaking her head as if she has come to the conclusion that Britt Marie is even slower than she'd thought.
"When we turn it around, we want to see it with you."
Liverpool never turn that match around. The final score is 2-2. It makes no difference, and it makes all the difference in the world. They have eggs and bacon in Banks's kitchen that night. Vega and Omar and Britt Marie and Bank and the dog. When Omar puts his elbows on the table, it's Vega who tells him to take them off. Their eyes meet for a moment, and then he does as she says without protest. Britt Marie stands in the hall as they put on their jackets. She curls up her toes in her shoes and brushes their arms until they have to hold her hands to make her stop. The young woman from the social services is standing on the lawn waiting for them.
"She's okay. She doesn't like football, but she's okay," says Vega to Britt Marie.
"We'll teach her,"
Omar assures her. Britt Marie sucks in her cheeks and nods.
The thing is that I just want to say that I... That you... That I never... She begins.
We know, mumbles Vega, deep into the fabric of Brit Marie's jacket.
It's cool,
Omar promises. The children have reached the road when the boy turns around. Brit Marie hasn't moved at all, as if she wants to preserve the image of them on her retinas until the very last. So he asks,
What are you doing tomorrow?
Brit Marie clasps her hands together on her stomach, inhales for as long as she can.
Kent will be waiting for me to knock on his door.
Vega shoves her hands in her pockets, raises her eyebrows.
And Sven?
Brit Marie inhales, exhales, lets Borg bounce around inside her lungs. He told me he hopes it's me every time there's a knock on his door. The children look so small, illuminated by the streetlights. But Vega stretches, straightens her back and says,
Do me a favour, Brit Marie.
Anything, she whispers.
Don't knock on any door tomorrow. Just get in the car and drive.
Brit Marie stands on her own in the dark, long after they've gone. She never said anything, has not promised anything. She knows it would have been a promise she could not keep. She stands on the balcony of Bank's house, feeling Borg blowing tenderly through her hair. Not so hard that it ruins her hairstyle, just enough to feel the breeze. The newspaper delivery drives past while it's still dark. The women with the Zimmer frames slowly make their way out of the house opposite, towards their postbox. One of them waves at Brit Marie, and she waves back. Not with her whole arm, obviously, but with a controlled movement, a discreet movement of one hand at the level of her hips, the way a person with common sense waves. She waves until the women have gone back into the house. Then she sneaks down the stairs and carries her bags out to the white car with the blue door. Before dawn, she's standing outside a door and knocking. Chapter 38 If a human being closes her eyes hard and long enough, she can remember all the times she has made a choice in her life, just for her own sake, and realize, perhaps, that it has never happened. If she drives a white car with a blue door slowly down a road through a village while it's still dark, and if she winds down the window and takes deep breaths, then she can remember all the men she has fallen in love with. Alf, Kent, Sven. One who deceived her and left her. Another who deceived her and was left by her. A third who is many things she has never had, but possibly none of the ones she has been longing for. And she can slowly, slowly, slowly unwrap the bandage from her hand and look at the white mark on her ring finger, while dreaming of first love and other chances and weighing up forgiveness against love, counting the beats of her heart. If a human being closes her eyes, she can remember all the choices in her life and realize they've all been for the sake of someone else. It's early morning in Borg, but the dawn seems to be holding off, as if it wants to give her time to raise her hand, make up her mind, and jump. She knocks on the door. It opens. She wants to say everything she feels inside, everything she's been carrying, but she never gets the chance. She wants to explain exactly why she's here and nowhere else, but she's interrupted. It makes her disappointed to realize she was expected and that she's so predictable. She wants to say something about how it feels to open her chest and let everything flow for the first time, but she is not given the opportunity. Instead, she is led with a firm hand back to the road. The pavement is dotted with plastic petrol cans, as if they've fallen off the back of a lorry.
Everyone in the team collected money. We've worked out the exact distance, says the boy. Those of us who can count have worked it out, yeah? The girl interjects. I can count, the boy cries angrily. Just about as much as you can kick a ball, so yeah, like you can count to three, grins the girl.
Brit Marie leans forward and feels the plastic jerry cans. They stink. Something brushes against her arms and it takes a good while before she realizes the children are holding both of her hands.
It's petrol. We've worked it out. There's enough here to get all the way to Paris, whispers Omar.
And all the way back, adds Vega.
They stand there waving while Britt Marie gets into the driver's seat. They wave with their entire bodies the way grown-ups never do. Morning comes to Borg with a sun that controls itself and waits respectfully on the horizon, as if wanting to give her enough time to make a last choice and then to choose for herself for the first time. When daylight finally streams in over the rooftops, a white car with a blue door starts pulling away. Maybe she stops. Maybe she knocks on just one more door. Maybe she just drives. God knows, Britt Marie certainly has enough fuel. It's January, in a place that is one of millions rather than one in a million. A place like all the others, and a place like no other. In a few months, 1,000 kilometres away, Liverpool will almost win the English Premier League. In one of the last matches, they will be leading 3-0 against Crystal Palace, but in 8 surreal minutes, they will let in 3 goals and lose the league title. No one in Liverpool will ever know anything about Borg. They won't even know the place exists. But no one who drives down this road with their windows rolled down will be able to avoid hearing the whole thing as it happens. Manchester United fire their manager and start again. Tottenham promise that next season will be better. Somewhere out there, people can still be found who support Aston Villa. It's January now, but spring will come to Borg. A young man will rest beside his mother in a churchyard, under a blanket of scarves. Two children will fall over themselves to deplore useless referees and pathetic sliding tackles. A ball will come rolling and a foot will kick it, because this is a community where no one knows how not to. A summer will come when Liverpool lose everything, and then autumn will arrive, and along with it a new season when they have another chance to win everything. Football is a mighty game in that way because it forces life to go on. Borg is exactly where it is, where it has always been. Borg is a place by a road that exits in two directions, one direction home and one to Paris. If you merely drive through Borg, it's easy to notice only the places that have been closed down. You have to slow down to see what's still there. There are people in Borg. There are rats and Zimmer frames and greenhouses, wooden fences and white jerseys and lit candles, newly laid turf and sunny stories. There's a florist where you can only buy red flowers. There's a corner shop and a car mechanic and a postal service and a pizzeria where the TV is always on whenever there's a match and where it's no shame to buy on credit. There isn't a recreation centre anymore, but there are children who eat bacon and eggs with their new coach and her dog, in a house with a balcony, in a living room where there are new photos on the wall. There are marginally fewer for sale signs along the road today than there were yesterday. There are grown men with beards and caps who play football in the beams of headlights from old trucks. There's a football pitch. There's a football club. And whatever happens, wherever she is, everyone will know Britt Marie was here.
Britt Marie Was Here, a novel, was written by Frederick Bachman and read by Joan Walker. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Britt Marie Was Here is available in print from Atria. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry, written by Frederick Bachman and read by Joan Walker.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.